submissive, we run the crowds out. Pump their rhythm is hitting, we wanna make it clear. We ain't scared, this is the vision we want. We want, we want, we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we discuss the importance of challenging dominant establishment narratives in the United States. We look at hidden history, the forbidden bookshelf, and the war on journalism continues at the Department of Homeland Security. We began in conversation with activist author John Gold about the importance of revisiting the history and politics behind the 9/11 Commission and other related issues. We talk with New York University Professor Mark Crispin Miller about his new series of publications called The Forbidden Bookshelf, which makes available groundbreaking but out-of-print books. We end the show with Dave Lindorf, who talks about how the Department of Homeland Security has labeled his collective, This Can't Be Happening, a national security threat. Please stay tuned. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we focus on hidden histories, forbidden bookshelves, the war on journalism, and we have some lively discussions in store for you, I'm certain. We'll begin with a conversation with author and activist John Gold, who's going to talk with us about his activism around 9/11 Commission and around victims and their families surrounding the 9/11 attacks. John Gold has been talking for some time about key issues that even some independent media won't discuss. We'll be dealing with that on the Project Censored Show today. Later on, Mark Crispin Miller joins us about his new and exciting book series, Forbidden Bookshelf, and we'll also be in contact with Dave Lindorf, who's going to tell us about how his journalistic collective has been targeted by Department of Homeland Security. So we have a pretty riveting hour here today on the Project Censored Show, and here is co-host Peter Phillips to introduce our first guest. Peter?
John Gold has been an advocate for 9/11 justice for over 12 years. He's been very supportive of the 9/11 family members seeking truth, accountability, and justice. He's also worked closely with 9/11 first responders, many who became ill because of the work they did. He is author of the book 9/11 Truther, The Fight for Peace, Justice, and Accountability. He was instrumental in making the film 9/11 Press for Truth, and he's been a contributor for HistoryCommons.org and Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. John, hello. Are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Peter and Mickey.
Hi, John. It's great to have you on board. Part of the research that you've been working with on the first responders, many have become quite ill. They're now saying that there's been over 1,000 people who are first responders on 9/11 that have died. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, James Zadroga was the first 9/11 first responder to die because of the environmental disaster that was the 9/11 attacks. In the days and months after 9/11, people at the EPA and elsewhere were giving false accounts as to the safety of the area. They said that the air was safe to breathe, that the water was safe to drink, and several thousand 9/11 first responders and people of New York got sick as a result of that. And today, 13 years later, well over 1,000 9/11 first responders have died due to 9/11 related illnesses. It seems every week John Feel, who is the head of the Feel Good Foundation, an organization that was instrumental in the passage of the James Zadroga 9/11 Health and Compensation Act, which finally gave some help to the 9/11 first responders, he posts news what seems like every week of a 9/11 first responder passing away, and it's horrible. No one was ever held accountable for this.
John Gold, Mickey Huff here. Thanks so much for joining us. I know we've talked about having you on the show for some time. Thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule to come on with us here on the Project Censored Show.
John, well, it's my pleasure.
John, I'm glad we started with the subject on the first responders. 9/11 is such a controversial matter, and it's oft muddled and lost in clouds of controversy. In some cases, manufactured controversy, using terms like conspiracy theory and these kind of things to muddy the waters. And I'm glad we started out with this particular topic, because this is a serious issue that until very recently got almost no attention. I find it ironic as well that it took Jon Stewart and the Daily Show to draw more attention to Congress's serious foot dragging on the matter. But I want to go back to the beginning of this, and it was in fact former Republican governor of New Jersey, Christy Todd Whitman, who was head of the EPA under George W. Bush, that lied to the public about the safety of the air, and that has gone relatively nowhere. That's another part of our sort of hidden history here.
Well, that happened under the direction of the White House. The White House had the EPA rewrite reports to say that things were safer than they were, and they knew otherwise. You know, one of the things that we talk about is whether or not elements within our government could be capable of hurting Americans with regards to the 9/11 attacks. And just look at the environmental impact and how 9/11 first responders were treated. That shows right there that there are people in government willing to put Americans in harm's way.
John Gold, we don't need to go to the Pentagon, and we don't need to go to areas where we don't have all of the factual information, maybe, that people like to speculate about. Here's a real live controversy and, well, you know, criminal acts lying to the public about safety issues.
Right. Well, if you look up the definition for the term second-degree murder, it clearly describes the actions of people like Christy Todd Whitman. And again, you know, she's never been held accountable. None of them have ever been held accountable. And I think at the very least, the 9/11 first responders deserve to see someone held accountable. It won't change their physical conditions, but it might give them a sense of satisfaction at least.
Now, there's increasing medical evidence, too, that the dust clouds were highly toxic, that many thousands of people were exposed to that. The theory is that in the rush to reopen Wall Street, the dust was declared safe. Is that correct, John?
Yes, that's correct. In an effort to reopen Wall Street, because money is obviously more important than people, they let everyone know that the air was safe to breathe and the water was safe to drink. And from what I understand, there were accounts of 9/11 first responders being told not to wear masks in an effort not to scare the public.
So even the public, all of Manhattan and for a very large area, was exposed to this dust and have been impacted. Their health has been impacted to varying degrees. Now skeptics would say, okay, 1,000 people have died. Certainly some of those would have died anyway. How do we know that it was related to exposure to environmental hazards? How do you respond to that?
Well, there's been several studies done that shows people who worked at down at the pile have developed more cancers, you know, than other groups. I couldn't name a study off the top of my head, but I know that several have been done. And it doesn't take rocket science to see that the afflictions that they have were caused by the toxic dust. And they had cancer in the lungs. They had, you know, some of them had what was called black lung disease. You know, coal miners suffer from that. You know, and these first responders have similar affliction, and it's not rocket science.
Mount Sinai Medical Center, of course, did a lot of work on this. There are a couple documentaries on it, Dust and Deceit. Even Juan Gonzalez did a book called Fallout, calling attention to this. Very serious matter, and as you said at the beginning, you know, people are dying as a result of this. Not only, you just said that basically you're alluding to the toxic stew, the World Trade Center site. It has even made its way into books about the history of asbestos affliction in the United States. A book by a guy named Bowker had a whole chapter in the book on 9/11 and asbestos and so on. So this is a very real issue, certainly something I know that you have been active around, both the first responders as well as you were an instrumental person helping out early on with the so-called Jersey Girls and the victims' families from 9/11.
I'm not going to say that I was helpful with the Jersey Girls in getting the creation of the 9/11 Commission done, but, you know, I've always been supportive of those family members seeking truth, accountability, and justice, especially, you know, after the release of the 9/11 report. There have been many instances where 9/11 family members have questioned what we were told in the so-called definitive account of 9/11, which the 9/11 report was sold as, and they've gotten little to no attention whatsoever. And I can give you a couple of instances. The September 11th advocates, or otherwise known as the Jersey Girls, have released press releases questioning a multitude of things about what we were told about the 9/11 Commission itself. You know, they've questioned, quote, the entire veracity of the 9/11 Commission. And each of these press releases has been almost completely ignored by the corporate media. In 2006, 9/11 family members Mindy Kleinberg and Lori Van Auken, who were both members of both the Jersey Girls and the 9/11 Family Steering Committee, wrote a report that showed how poorly the 9/11 Commission answered their questions. And that got no media attention whatsoever. The documentary, 9/11 Press for Truth, was released in September of 2006. That was virtually ignored by the mainstream media. And this is a documentary that calls into question the 9/11 Commission and its account, and it's endorsed by the family members that fought for it. You would think something like that would get attention, but instead, what got attention at the time was Ann Coulter and her slanderous remarks against the Jersey Girls. It should have been the other way around. 9/11 Press for Truth should have gotten all the attention, and Ann Coulter should have been ignored.
John, I wanted to get to the commission itself. I mean, because you've done a lot of work on what's known about the commission. And, I mean, even the legal lead counsel to the commission, John Farmer, said that the government agreed not to tell the truth about 9/11, called it a whitewash in his book, The Ground Truth. Philip Zelikow is a name you don't hear very often in public, but he was one of the chief folks behind the scenes, clearly distorting and directing what became the 9/11 official narrative. Can you talk more about that?
In my opinion, Philip Zelikow belongs in jail. I want to see him in a courtroom, on the stand, under oath, with regards to his participation in the 9/11 cover-up. I think it's a thread that, if tugged on, could unravel the whole 9/11 cover-up. This is a man who had so many conflicts of interest within the Bush administration. He wrote the preemptive war strategy that was eventually used in Iraq. He was part of the Bush transition team. He wrote a book with Condoleezza Rice, and these are all things that a lot of people know. But some of the things that people don't know is that he wrote a complete outline with Ernest May of the final 9/11 report before the investigation even got underway. And I quickly want to say, Ernest May passed away, and the further away we get from that day, the harder it will be to get to the truth. And I just wanted to point that out. He rewrote the 9/11 report to be more favorable of Condoleezza Rice. In fact, he actually told staffers to believe Rice's account over Richard Clark's account. He tried to insert a false link between Iraq and Al-Qaeda into the 9/11 report. And 9/11 family member Lori Van Auken confronted him on this and said, how dare you? I can find the actual quote if you give me a minute of what she said to him.
Well, John, we probably don't have time for you to find it live on air, but do you have...
Okay, no, that's fine.
Do you have a link or a place? I know you do a lot of writing online. Do you have a place you could tell people or direct people to what you think is some of the more responsible writing and research around 9/11 issues?
Well, historycommons.org is actually one of the most important websites on the internet, as far as I'm concerned, with regards to information about 9/11. They have something called a complete 9/11 outline that goes over the issues that I'm talking about. And I'd like to continue talking a little bit more about Zelikow.
Please do.
He made sure that Saudi investigators had a hard time gaining access to information, and even fired Dana Liesemann for going behind his back to get some of that information. He took part in a, quote, late-night editing session, end quote, with Dieter Snell to remove possible Saudi support for the hijackers from the 9/11 report. I think it was moved to a footnote in the back of the book. He may have taken direction from Karl Rove. And that revelation caused the Jersey Girls to call for an entirely new investigation in February 2008. And that's another instance where family members have spoken out and have been completely ignored. The families called for his resignation during the time of the 9/11 Commission on two separate occasions. And the corporate media didn't cover that. In fact, I think Amy Goodman might have been the only one to cover that. That should speak volumes to the American people. This is a man who was in charge of the 9/11 Commission itself. He was in charge of who would be questioned, what questions would be asked. He had more power, as Paul Sperry wrote a long time ago, than any of the 9/11 commissioners. And I believe that he belongs in jail for his participation in the cover-up. I can go on about the 9/11 Commission itself, some of the faults with it. They had what were called government minders who would accompany witnesses to the 9/11 Commission that essentially intimidated witnesses. They would sometimes answer questions for witnesses. It's incredible to me that stuff like that took place. Now, the mandate of the 9/11 Commission, and I'm going to read it to you. The Commission's mandate is to provide a, quote, full and complete accounting of the attacks of September 11, 2001, and recommendations as to how to prevent such attacks in the future. Specifically, Section 604 of Public Law 107-306 requires the Commission to investigate, quote, facts and circumstances relating to the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, including those relating to intelligence agencies, law enforcement agencies, diplomacy, immigration, non-immigrant visas, and border control, the flow of assets to terrorist organizations, commercial aviation, the role of congressional oversight and resource allocation, and other areas determined relevant by the 9/11 Commission for its inquiry. So everything that they omitted from their report, and I'm talking about things like whistleblowers with pertinent information that the 9/11 Commission ignored and censored, these are people who had pertinent information regarding the 9/11 attacks, and the 9/11 Commission ignored them. That in and of itself shows that the 9/11 Commission failed in its mandate. The 9/11 Commission barely investigated the National Security Agency. And recently we've heard from whistleblowers like William Binney and Thomas Drake that showed that the NSA had information that could have prevented the attacks, and they were hardly investigated by the 9/11 Commission. How could something created by such a compromised and corrupt commission be considered truth? And I'm referring specifically to the 9/11 report. Yes. It's unfathomable to me.
We're speaking with John Gold, who's the author of the book 9/11 Truther, The Fight for Peace, Justice, and Accountability. John, it's certainly true that the 9/11 Commission report was fast, underfunded, a quick result, covered up a lot of things, and left unanswered a huge number of very, very important questions. And certainly more information has been forthcoming over the past dozen years in terms of Saudi connections and Prince Bandahar and some of the hijackers were where they got money and a variety of issues along those lines. Where do you think we're going with this? Is there an opportunity for a new commission some point down the line? And what's happening with this initiative in New York called the High Rise Safety Initiative?
Well, the families right now are fighting for the right to sue Saudi royals that may have helped finance the attacks, including, I think, Prince Bandar. And if they can get 9/11 into a courtroom, I think it would open up the door to many things. And I think that's what the families are fighting for. Right now, we're waiting on the Supreme Court, I believe, to hear whether or not they'll hear the Saudi appeal, which goes against this decision that was made in December 2013 that said the families do have the right to sue. And so if it gets into a courtroom, there's no telling what could happen or what things could come up. With regards to the initiative in New York City, it's getting actually a fairly decent amount of corporate media attention. I've seen articles in the Huffington Post and elsewhere, Washington Times, giving them some attention, but they're referring to them as conspiracy theorists. And, you know, the phrase conspiracy theorist or conspiracy theory is just a phrase used by the establishment to either silence or discredit dissent. That's all it's used for. You know, if they get on the ballot, that more power to them. I've never been one to focus on the buildings myself. I think there are other areas of concern that might merit more attention from the American people in the world. But, you know, more power to them. If they get on the ballot, I hope it goes through.
Well,
Well, John Gold, it's important to call attention to this. And, you know, as you said earlier in our discussion, the further we get away from the event, the more cemented in the minds of many become the official narratives that are in many cases manufactured out of thin air by people like Philip Zelikow and so on. So we want to thank you for your tireless activism and your attention, particularly your assistance with first responders and calling attention to the many problems of the ongoing cover-up via the 9/11 Commission. John Gold, author of 9/11 Truther, The Fight for Peace, Justice, and Accountability. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Peter and Mickey, for having me on today.
Mm-hmm. After this musical break, we'll be back with Professor Mark Crispin Miller to talk about the Forbidden Bookshelf. Please stay with us.
Nurture the soil beside you. Seek my sunlight for its photosynthetic value. You were the missing theme, the novel of my inner mind. I was the perfect storm that rained, not at the perfect time. We were the tracks that transverse and parallel across the depths of Jupiter where our chi dwells. I am the moon that orbits you as you orbit the sun. You were the vessel that transported me where I was from. We synthesized time and plucked the notes of string theory. You led me through the labyrinth when I couldn't see clearly. I am the gravity that keeps you spinning on your axis. You are the windmill, the backspin, the all splashed on my canvas.
You are tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. For over half a century, America's vast literary culture has been disparately policed and imperceptibly contained by state and corporate entities well-placed and perfectly equipped to wipe out wayward writings. As America does not ban books, other means, less evident and so less controversial, have been developed to vaporize them. The purpose of Forbidden Bookshelf, a new series by Mark Crispin Miller, is to bring such vanished books to life. These works pull some of the most troubling trends and episodes in U.S. history from the shadows, shed light on how America got to its present moment, and show us how we all might change direction. Our next guest is Professor Mark Crispin Miller. He is professor of media studies at New York University and accomplished author of several books, from Boxed In, The Culture of TV, Seeing Through Movies, also The Bush Dyslexicon, Observations on a National Disorder, and Fooled Again, The Real Case for Election Reform. He's written many articles for newspapers and journals. He's been published in The New York Times, The Nation, New Republic, New York Review of Books, on and on through his blog, News from Underground. He writes and talks about underreported stories. Mark Crispin Miller is also one of the many judges that works with Project Censored. Mark Crispin Miller, thank you for joining us by phone from New York City today.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Mark, it's absolutely a pleasure. I've enjoyed talking with you the past couple days and certainly looking into the Forbidden Bookshelf published by Open Road Media. People can learn more about that, openroadmedia.com. These are e-books. Tell us about this Forbidden Bookshelf series, what brought it about, and then let's get a little more specific about it.
Absolutely. Well, I've wanted to do this for a long time for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, as a teacher, I've often found over the years that books I've wanted to, you know, assign in class are out of print and unavailable. And that's a problem, I think, that's been increasing over the last few decades and has everything to do with, you know, changes in the nature of the book publishing business. And then also, as like you guys, a student of, you know, the means whereby democracy is blocked and denied, I've come to know about a lot of examples of authors whose books have been killed in one way or another. You know, not, as you noted in the introduction there, through outright banning, because we don't do that in this country, but in more inexplicit ways, you know, through threats of litigation by powerful corporations or reviewers refusing to discuss or mention certain books regardless of their importance, or most often reviewers laughing books off as conspiracy theory. And you just had Jack Gold on, and that's a good example right there. So, you know, my idea was there should be a new series of books republished. You know, yank them from this undeserved obscurity, make them available again, make them available with new introductions, and where appropriate with new chapters to update their stories. And that's, I'm pleased to say, what Open Road Media has agreed to do. We're going to do 12 titles a year. These are e-books, I have to make clear. The economies of publishing make that a more viable course. I mean, I wish the books were available in old-fashioned print editions as well. But for now, at any rate, they're available as e-books. They have new introductions, and we just came out with the first 5 titles on June 10th, and we'll talk about those specifically. We have another 6 coming out in September, and as I say, we'll be doing a dozen each year thereafter.
Mark, hi, this is Peter Phillips. I'm looking at some of the titles that you presented. One that caught my eye right away was The Lords of Creation, the history of America's 1%, which was published during the Depression, I believe.
That's right.
And it's a financial catastrophes, how they happened then, and of course they still happen now. Bankers, railroad tycoons, steel magnates, speculators, scoundrels, robber barons, all the above back then. And certainly we have remnants of that now. So what happened to this book? Why isn't it available?
Well, you know, in some cases, we pick books that you might say were conveniently forgotten, you know. And I don't pretend that there was any kind of deliberate plot not to republish The Lords of Creation. But the fact that it's been out of print is very striking, because Frederick Lewis Allen, who was a very popular writer in the 20s and 30s. I mean, he was the editor of Harper's. You know, he was a well-known figure. His other popular histories are still in print. Somehow this one, the one about the robber barons, is not in print. If you go online and look at the paperback edition that came out in 1966, and I picked up a copy myself back in the 70s for a couple of bucks. It's going online on Amazon for like $2,000, you know. So what we did was we are republishing it in this first tranche of titles, and it has a terrific introduction by Gretchen Morgenson of the New York Times, and I think the best financial reporter at that paper by far. And she notes all the ways in which the story that Frederick Lewis Allen tells, the rise of the robber barons, is both very different from what's going on today, but more importantly, very similar. There's a lot of continuities. In fact, there are more continuities than differences. And the urgency of the book remains, you know, it hasn't changed one bit. If anything, it's you know, more noticeable than ever. Let me add that it is a beautifully written and often hilarious book. It's no dry economic history, but it's a really powerful economic and social history of all these figures, you know, from Morgan and Rockefeller and Harriman and the rest of them. It's a book that I think should be taught in all the high schools and colleges, and I think it should have been adapted as a kind of series on PBS. If we were living in a different kind of world, the book would be very well known, and there'd be no reason for us to put it in the forbidden bookshelf. But now I'm happy to say it's back, and it's selling pretty well.
Well, I was certainly going to consider it for my political sociology class in the fall.
Great.
And so long, I've always studied power elites and the histories there. Gustav Meyer's History of Great American Fortunes is one classic book in that area.
Absolutely.
Beard's book, Economic Interpretations of the Constitution, very strong. Of course,
right.
Lumberg's America's 60 Families. All of those were written about the same time, you know, right before the Depression or during the Depression, about how elites had really dominated and were controlling the country, and wealth was concentrated. And then we went into the Depression and a series where middle class did better. But now we're back into that whole series again. It seems like you're really approaching this from a very open way. I thank you for that effort.
Well, thank you. I wanted to ask you something. I've looked at those other titles. Gustavus Meyer's books are in the public domain, and in fact, Amazon sells Kindle editions of that one.
Really?
Yeah, it's interesting. But I've been trying to decide whether we should do Matthew Josephson's book, The Robber Barons, which is another one that came out during
book.
That period. Do you think that's one we should do as well?
I would highly recommend it, yes.
Okay, good. That's great. You know, one of the fun things about this project is precisely this. You know, one can ask friends and associates to name titles that they think that American readers should know, we've gotten a lot of stuff that way. And, of course, we also hear from many unstable people who recommend books that are not necessary, but it takes all kinds.
Well, Mark Crispin Miller, I know we've talked before. I know you have I.F. Stone coming out and some various things. I'd certainly like to see The Killings at Kent State, How Murder Went Unpublished re-emerge, but we can talk about some more of those, more fodder for the list at another time. But right now, since we have you on the line,
right.
Let's look at, we just talked a little about Lords of Creation. You also have Douglas Valentine's book, The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam. You have Christopher Simpson, Blowback, America's Recruitment of Nazis and Its Destructive Impact on Our Domestic and Foreign Policy. The Search for an Abortionist, the classic study of how American women coped with unwanted pregnancy before Roe v. Wade. That's Nancy Howell Lee. And the fifth book that you've just put out here from June 10th for the first in the Forbidden Bookshelf series, Dan Moldea. Dan, a favorite of mine. This one, though, is Interference, How Organized Crime Influenced Professional Football. Dan's book on Reagan and the Mob and MCA and the Mob, I thought, was always a good one. But you've got some interesting books here. Why don't you, you want to pick one of these, or maybe pick Valentine's book or one of these?
Yeah, absolutely.
And riff a little bit on not only why these are important as historical documents, but how they are passed as prologue, how they provide context for us to understand the present. We just heard in Lords of Creation how it's like deja vu all over again.
Right.
Tell us about this, Valentine's work.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Well, Doug Valentine's book on the Phoenix Program is, on the one hand, an indispensable history for understanding the real character of the Vietnam War, that it was not a noble error, as Reagan called it, and not simply a tragedy for us, but a continuous atrocity, a tissue of war crimes. And the best way to understand its character is to look into the Phoenix Program, which was a CIA pacification program that entailed basically a full surveillance of the South Vietnamese civilian population, the use of computers to list their names, and then the consolidation of the police and military and intelligence agencies basically to target anyone who was called or deemed to be part of the Viet Cong infrastructure, the VCI, or even helpful to or sympathetic to the Viet Cong. Now, what this actually amounted to, although it was ostensibly an attempt to combat terror by the VC, it was in itself a terror program of targeted assassination, torture, rape of Vietnamese civilians whose names were often picked for reasons of corruption. Somebody might have had a grudge, or a peasant might not have paid somebody off. What you had was a terrifying system, a terrorizing system that led directly to the assassination and or torture of tens of thousands of Vietnamese civilians. Now, on the one hand, you know, it does shed a very unflattering and accurate light on that conflict. But as your question suggests, and more frighteningly, the Phoenix Program actually tells us a lot about what's going on even here today in our war on terror. Doug Valentine has written a terrific introduction to this edition called The Phoenix Has Landed, and his point is that this very systematic effort to keep the population cowed and silent, subjecting the population to completely unconstitutional mistreatment, it really does speak to what we're living through now. He mentions the fact that Americans can now be assassinated through the use of drones. American citizens can be legally killed by the American government with drones. He talks about the fact that it is now legal for our military to detain American civilians indefinitely and bring them up before secret courts for trial. The point is that the book, it tells us all too much about what's actually going on today, so that the Phoenix Program in Vietnam could be treated and could be regarded as a kind of template for a huge move against democracy, not only in other countries, but here as well. So it's a book that I very, very strongly recommend, and one that was sidelined when it came out. It's a little bit interesting to talk about what Doug Valentine went through in writing it. He met with William Colby, the head of the CIA, who had been the most vocal defender of the Phoenix program before Congress. This is in the early 90s when Doug started working on the book. And because Colby was amenable to the project, he spread the word through the CIA that people who had been part of the program should talk to Doug about it. So for a few years, he got a lot of terrific interviews, and the book is very, very thoroughly sourced and documented. And then it dawned on the agency that it was probably not in their best interest to be so candid with him. So they shut down. They refused to talk to him, and they even spread the word to other government agencies to clam up. So this led to his filing a lawsuit against them. The ACLU helped out. At any rate, he'd done most of the research he needed. The book came out, and then it got a very bad review from Morley Safer of CBS. Maybe at the behest of the agency. Wouldn't be that surprising. Maybe not. But in any case, it put an end to Doug Valentine's career as a writer who would be published by major houses. Since then, even though he's continued to work, it's only small and marginal houses that have published his work. So it's important that people know about that first book of his through the Forbidden Bookshelf.
And in your layout there, it says that between 65 and 72, more than 80,000 noncombatants were, quote, neutralized as men and women were subject to extended imprisonment, torture, horrific rape, and in many cases, execution. So even if you didn't die, you were brutalized so deeply that you were pretty much ineffective as a human being. Mark, is that really new? I mean, certainly after World War II, we were intervening. The U.S. intervened in Italy and in Greece. We intervened in Central America for many generations. And the activities, certainly in Latin America after Vietnam in the 80s, were identification of leftists and helping governments repress in El Salvador and other places. So in many ways, this has continued as a policy of oppression worldwide and even worldwide today.
Oh, absolutely. And I didn't mean to imply otherwise. That's absolutely right. I mean, I jumped from the Phoenix program as it was set up in South Vietnam to the United States today. It is important, as you note, to trace the recurrence of that same model throughout the world. The same thing happened in Nicaragua and El Salvador and Honduras. What's notable is that the PRU, the Provisional Reconnaissance Units, they were called in South Vietnam, were comprised of extremely bloodthirsty troops under the command of CIA officers. They're the ones who carried out most of the atrocities. Well, we've seen this happen time and time again. We're seeing it now in Ukraine, aren't we?
Syria, Egypt.
Yeah, I mean, we could just go on and on.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's absolutely not unique to South Vietnam, but the systematization of which Colby was very proud, you know, and which he didn't apologize for, the systematic use of high technology and the combination of police, military, and intelligence agencies. You know, we're talking about something that, as you note, had in its way gone on prior to the Vietnam War. But we're also, I think, obliged to note increasing efforts to rationalize this process, you know, systematize it. And the Phoenix program was, indeed, a grotesquely successful example of such a systematization, if you see what I mean. And I think it has gone on consistently since then. It is going on now. And I think Doug's point in his introduction is that those chickens have come home to roost. You know, once I know you've heard this before, this line, but the foreign minister of Nicaragua under the Sandinistas once said famously, although not famously enough, someday the American people will be the most repressed on earth. It's a chilling prophecy. I mean, time will tell if that actually turns out to be true, but you know, there's grounds for saying that we're on our way.
Well, Colby, in fact, was quoted as saying at an early Reagan meeting, CIA Director Colby, that we'll know our disinformation campaign is complete when everything the American public believes is false.
He actually said that. Did he really?
Yeah, I traced it to the Philadelphia Inquirer, and it's in one of our censored books. I just thought it was a pretty profound kind of statement
that is amazing.
Really good. Well, look, it goes back, as you well know, to Operation Mockingbird and the whole CIA hatching of the term conspiracy theory to,
right,
you know, cast a pall over certain subjects and demonize people and invoke the great triumvirate of fallacies. They ad hominem, red herring, and straw person. Any way we can distract people, Mark Crispin Miller, in this Forbidden Bookshelf, I think think is a welcome wake-up call. That, and I think the introduction you had to the series is really well put and succinct in so far as you're talking about, well, there are bans on books in the United States, but it's mostly based on, you know, local school board issues and so on. And, you know, again, I work on Banned Books Week, so there are challenges to books and so on. But you're talking about the systematic disappearing of entire ways of thinking and critiquing the establishment.
That's absolutely right. And I can't resist making a point to you, since you've noted that Colby made this outrageous statement, which I'm sure he made sincerely, you know, that disinformation, the process of disinformation will be complete when everything American people think is false. And you link that with the sort of deliberate stigmatization of dissident ideas or forbidden truths as conspiracy theory, so that the press completely avoids a whole broad range of subjects. I mean, isn't it ironic that one of those subjects would be William Colby's own death, right? Here's a guy who just suddenly up and left the dinner table, his house on the Maryland shore, and went and drowned, right? He went sailing and he drowned. Dinner was still on the table. And this is one of these things that you kind of have to search to find out, but he died under extremely mysterious circumstances, you know? And one would like to know why and who did it, but that's a conspiracy theory, I guess.
Well, certainly the Forbidden Bookshelf is going to give us a lot to think about, rethink about for some, but as you state in the intro to the series, you know, it's the first time that many people will see these, even those among us that try to pay attention and try to make serious efforts to inform ourselves and those around us. So kudos to you, Mark Kristen Miller, for the Forbidden Bookshelf. We definitely look forward to more of the titles. And could you give folks the website? I know you have markkristenmiller.com. Is that the best place for people to find out about you?
Yeah, that's News from Underground, my own blog. That's a good way, markkristenmiller.com. And to find the books themselves, just go to openroadmedia.com. I'm grateful for you guys having me on, and I'll be glad to come back on in September when we do our next six titles, which, as you noted, include I.F. Stone's Hidden History of the Korean War and Assassination on Embassy Row by Saul Landau and John Dinges, with a new introduction by Ariel Dorfman. It's a great list, and we're really looking forward to doing it.
Mark Kristen Miller, professor at NYU in New York City, thank you so much for all of your contributions, and especially this new endeavor on the Forbidden Bookshelf. We will definitely have you back on the program this September. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you. Thank you both. Bye-bye.
After a musical break, we will be joined by Dave Lindorf to talk about why Department of Homeland Security believes his journalist collective is a threat. Stay with us.
Rebellion politics, the opposite of what you know is politics, where corporate capital makes the government break their promise. It's a new day where people create the policy. The economy trickles up to eradicate the poverty. So get up, stand up. These are our demands. What? We want our money back. So politicians, get your hands up. Equal distribution of the land and the profits. An end to all war and a socialized democracy.
I'm fighting, inciting the clash of the titans. The premises, fighting my nemesis. Fighting, exciting the right wing with media hype. But Chelsea was right, so believe the hype. Perceiving the issues, leading the fist with even intent to say he's taking missiles. Visible agents, they packing the pistols. Subliminal goals, steal your souls. For global control, corporations back home. Political whores patrolling the shores. Wars and stores, the chief is all poor. Knowing the cure for what's at the core. Blowing the floor, the third world war. Creating the wars for mineral ore. Come on, y'all. We gotta fight back with rebellion politics. The opposite of what you know is politics. Where corporate capital makes the government break their promise. It's a new day where people create the policy. The economy trickles up to eradicate the poverty. So get up, stand up. These are our demands. We want our money back. So politicians, get your hands up. Equal distribution of the land and the profits. An end to all war and a socialized democracy.
speaking as the voice of the masses. Defeated, mistreated, believe it. You beat us, robbed us, aghast us. We've been passed up, locked up, exploited, and downsized. But we will uprise, no compromise. This is the fight next time. My mind is still inclined to form a rhythmic rhyme. But I got enzymes in my blood that let me break it down each time. So I can't digest all that that you feed me. You think hip hop is antisocial? You ain't reading graffiti. Cause you ignored us like the writing on an Indian treaty. We from the seedy, needy streets of each American city. Where it's gritty and grimy, public school hallways, never shiny. But police be eyeing me cause public policy criminalized me. It kept us in poverty like a thorough resident. Nobody's exempt, not even the brother of the president. Rebellion politics and rebellion scholarship. The science of survival in a repressive environment. Rebellion politics, the opposite of what you know is politics. Where corporate capital makes the government break their promise. It's a new day where people create the policy. The economy trickles up to eradicate the poverty. So get up, stand up. These are all demands. What we want, our money back. So politicians, get your hands up. Equal distribution of the land and the profits. An end to all war and a socialized democracy.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. In our final segment today, we are joined by an independent journalist who's going to tell us about how he recently learned that his journalist collective in Philadelphia, This Can't Be Happening, has been labeled a national security threat by folks at the Department of Homeland Security. It is a long and twisted tale, but we are going to hear it. Peter, please introduce our next guest.
Dave Lindorf is an award-winning independent journalist and founder of the website thiscan'tbehappening.net. It's a news collective based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. This Can't Be Happening is published by the Collective, a partnership established and owned by journalists John Grant, Dave Lindorf, Lynn Washington, and Charles Young. Dave, are you with us?
I am. Hi, Peter.
Well, I'm reading this release that you wrote. It says, This Can't Be Happening has learned that our little news organization was listed in an alert fired to all 78 fusion centers by Kelly Wilson, director of Washington, D.C.'s Fusion Center Regional Threat and Assessment, and that you are a potential threat. So what did you do to get identified by Homeland Security?
Well, it actually is a very revealing and interesting story. This dates from 2011, November 2011. The memo is dated November 18th, and it actually went to 72 fusion centers because some of them, like the one here in Philly, hadn't been constructed yet. Now there are 78, but it did go to 72, and it warned them that our little news organization had broken a story exposing the role of Department of Homeland Security and other agencies in the central government, notably the FBI, in orchestrating the crackdown on the Occupy movement. We had done a piece that we ran on our site on the 15th of November, which was picked up by a lot of other sites, you know, Counterpunch, Nation of Change, I think Common Dreams, and some other ones.
Project Censored.
Which is part of our strategy, is to have our stuff stolen, you know, because we're a little outfit. But, you know, if we're stolen, we get a lot broader readership. So anyway, they said that our article had exposed this, but the interesting thing was they said, I love the phrasing of this, they said, although these references to fusion centers and Occupy seem to be compartmentalized, and by that they mean to the alternative press, I wanted to make you aware of these references in case the national news media began speculating about fusion center involvement.
Dave, tell our listeners about it. What is a fusion center? Tell our listeners about this. The fusion centers have been very controversial. They've been associated with a lot of civil liberties issues and infractions. Bo Hodai has written about this, several others. So just tell our listeners briefly what about this. What is a fusion
center? Well, the fusion centers were established by the Department of Homeland Security after 9/11. It was one of those things. It was part of this idea of connecting all the dots and that they talked about that supposedly they hadn't done before 9/11, which is also a debatable issue, of course. But what they morphed into is these huge, totally unregulated, mergers of the intelligence operations of regional FBI offices, regional DEA offices, regional Department of Defense operations, you know, DIA and so on. All the various three-lettered intelligence outfits of the federal government have regional offices, and they're linked through in the fusion centers, which are all in major cities, with the local police, as well as state police and, you know, various law enforcement in the regions around where they're located. So what makes them particularly outrageous and dangerous is that they aren't federal units, federal entities. They aren't local entities. They aren't state entities. They're sort of a mishmash that don't have any direct oversight by anybody. And what we learned from this was that while they were supposedly designed to target terrorism and to look for signs of terrorist activity in their regions, they were devoting all their efforts during the Occupy movement to spying on and crushing the Occupy movement. And they did this by coordinating what each municipality did to its Occupy movement and picking and choosing the things that seemed to work best, like using maximum force at night, keeping the press at bay so they couldn't show the horrific things that were being done to peaceful protesters and so on.
Dave Lindorf, you know, we're in the San Francisco Bay Area in Berkeley, and Oakland, California was one of the places where, you know, a lot of this violence went down, and in fact, that's even noted in your piece.
Yeah, in fact, the cracking down on the Oakland Occupy movement was kind of the kickoff for the national campaign of crushing the movement everywhere. It was a meeting of mayors that began after that crackdown, meeting with the mayor of Oakland,
Gene Kwan.
And the thing was, they made it out that this was a bunch of mayors who, on their own initiative, got together 18 mayors to talk about the Occupy movement. But actually, we later learned that it was the Homeland Security that had orchestrated that get together and enabled it, you know, through their facilities for telecommunications and so on, so that these mayors could talk about what worked, you know, which in the Oakland case was maximum violence, a militaristic approach by the police, dressed in black and armed to the teeth, using beanbag guns.
And provocateurs.
And provocateurs, storming a peaceful camp that even had kids in it, smashing tents, everything. You know, it was done in a very sort of Iraq war kind of style, and it was deliberately done at night to maximize the fear and to try to intimidate people from further participation. And then this moved, and you started seeing the same things done everywhere.
Dave Lindorf, in New York City. At the same time, Dave Lindorf, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were crowing about democracy movements in Egypt and the rights of people to protest while they were shooting Scott Olson in the face.
And they were insisting that the federal government had no interest in Occupy, that this was, you know, people exercising their they talked nobly about people exercising their rights, and they talked about this isn't a federal issue, this is for local people, local authorities to deal with responsibly, and blah, blah, blah. But it turned out that Homeland Security was intimately involved in orchestrating a crackdown.
Right.
And as we know later, there was a serious threat of shooting and killing the leaders of Occupy.
Yes.
In Houston, which I wrote about.
We reviewed that story. So,
in your latest thing, yeah, no. So that's great. I mean, I think it's a huge story that got no coverage and should have. This is the kind of thing that should have evoked Senate hearings into what the hell is the FBI doing, not prosecuting something like that, or were they even involved in it?
Indeed, and remember that at the time, even Naomi Wolf, when she suggested that there was this kind of national orchestration, she was called a conspiracy theorist. Oh, there's that term again. There's that label, right, to quiet people down. And it turns out that the things that she was positing and the things now that we're talking about, in fact, happened.
Absolutely. There were police provocateurs in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, in Oakland, in New York. They were everywhere. The interesting thing is they were trying desperately to infiltrate the leadership of the Occupy, but there was none.
Right. Well, Dave Lindorf...
It may have saved people in Houston because they wanted to target the leaders for assassination, but they couldn't probably figure out who they were.
Dave Lindorf, we're actually out of time for the segment here today. A quick last word.
We're just very honored to have been selected as a national threat for the threat being exposing the role, nefarious role of Homeland Security.
Dave, real quick, has there been consequences from that? is there a measurable impact? We know that these fusion centers interlink with all the you know, agencies in the U.S., but then many of those interlink with business groups locally and that sort of thing. Have you been?
Oh, absolutely.
Have
you
been impacted?
That's the other thing they're linked to. They're linked to the security outfits of the businesses. But I, you know, personally, the only impact I've had is being invited on your show.
Well, Dave, congratulations. We welcome you on the show. We encourage listeners to go to thiscan'tbehappening.net. Thanks, as always, for your work, Dave Lindorf.
Thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacific Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Special thanks to Anthony Fest, our producer. Special thanks to Erica Bridgman at the controls. We invite you to tune in to the Project Censored Show next week, 4th of July, for a special on American Independence, where we will be talking about American Free Thought, a documentary series. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. It's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cars that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring, an anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces, slaving for almighty dollar bills.